Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema, giving you a new, classic, independent, foreign, or all-around awesome film every day. For your free trial of Mubi over the course of 1 month, you can go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable. This is the spin-off podcast for the world-destroying Film Stage show. During these episodes, rather than review a film in depth, we will be tackling a broad range of discussion topics related to the whole of film culture. With me today, as always, now, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And we also have Michael Snydell.
Hello!
Holy shit, just one time that time.
I know, I kind of just committed to first and last name. This is an important episode of the Film Stage Roundtable, because through a simple plaster wall sleeps a two-month-old who could derail this entire episode if she decides to wake up. That is, of course, my daughter, Cora. And everyone out there, just send good vibes. Let's try to keep her asleep throughout the recording of this. I am looking at her baby monitor. She is sleeping much as a rock. So, I think we're cool. Let's get into it. We want to extend an invitation to everyone out there to let us know what kinds of things you want to hear more about. Once again, one of our topics today was selected by someone on Twitter. If there's a particular bit of film news or any topic that you'd like us to tackle, just give us a tweet, reach out. Your engagement is what makes this whole thing work. Speaking of which, Twitter. You can find us at Film Stage Show. You can also find us on Facebook, that is searching for The Film Stage Show. And you can email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. Also, we love getting comments and ratings on iTunes, so we fully encourage you to take a minute to search us out and let us know what you think, especially if you like us 5 stars worthy. And you can, of course, comment on the pages that these episodes are posted on thefilmstage.com.
Does that mean there's no Google Plus?
Nope, no Google Plus.
And is still a thing?
No. Is it?
I don't know.
I don't think so. Probably not.
I mean, in Google's eyes, it probably is. But in the rest of the world, it's probably like, no, that's not a thing.
This whole episode is going to be a one-hour investigation into whether or not Google Plus is still technically a thing.
That's going to be scary.
Probably
this,
as dated
this is
going
to give me nightmares.
Yeah. This is true. Before we get into everything, let me remind everyone that we are sponsored by Mubi, the curated online cinema. Every day, Mubi selects a brand new film, an incredible piece of cinematic art, which you will have 30 days to watch. And at the end of the 30 days, it disappears. But it's okay, because every day a new film is on for 30 days. My favorite thing about Mubi is, of course, I say this all the time, the fact that you can download these films. So if you're trekking out into the wilderness with your family, you can maintain your cinematic isolation from the people who love you by downloading onto Mubi and not having to worry about spotty Wi-Fi out in the wilderness. Currently on Mubi, there's actually a new film up called The Glass Shield. Is anyone aware of this film?
Charles Burnett?
Yes. The director of Killer of Sheep. And this is one of those movies that you just don't really see anywhere else. You can find it on Mubi, though, and you can download it, and you can watch it, and you can love it, as you should. So that is Mubi, MUBI.com. And you get a free month on us if you go to MUBI.com/filmstage. So go there, check it out, enjoy it, and of course, tweet
us. So much good stuff on there.
There's so much stuff.
And they have crazy.
It's not just random either. I mean, they have series.
No.
They had their Jacques Rivette tribute.
Sure.
Still not cheering for Jacques Rivette. That's cool.
Hey, we cheered last time.
We gave him.
I'll get to it in the next couple days.
Okay. Once his movies have cycled out. But anyway, that's exactly. Mubi. We all love Mubi. Mubi is awesome. So check out Mubi, MUBI.com/filmstage for your free month. Whew. All right. We have two topics today because we're doing two now instead of three because we love talking far too much. So our first topic is... Bill, you going to be all right?
Yeah.
Okay. Our first topic is, just keep repeating, it's only a movie.
Oof.
That is the main theme from Suspiria by Dario Argento. I just kind of want to let it keep rolling throughout this whole podcast.
You should play that for your baby.
Oh, don't think that I have.
It's a good lullaby.
You know, you laugh.
Babies don't know anything yet. They don't know that that's creepy as fuck.
It's not like there's haunting like lyrics or anything. It's just Goblin like whispering menacingly into a microphone. Currently, my baby's favorite lullabies are actually Irish fighting songs. Stuff like Foggy Dew and The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
The Pogues?
No, I'm not singing Shipping Up to Boston. This is like 1918 resistance stuff. My wife is cool with it. My mother, not so much. But anyway, that's not important. We can talk about that when we get to the score, which is what we're talking about on our second topic. Currently, we're going to be talking about... films that scare us. Pointedly not saying horror films. Because sometimes when you're a kid, or even as an adult, you get scared by stuff that's not even supposed to scare you. So we're leaving it open. We talked about Don't Breathe on the last review podcast, which has been getting a lot of love for being super tense and scary. So we wanted to capitalize off the zeitgeist. And because being scared is fun, we decided we would share some of the movies that, in the moment, scared us the most. Whether they're true horror... or just horrifying. These are movies that left us shaking in our boots. Have you guys ever seen Killer Clowns from Outer Space?
I've only seen it on the Netflix queue. And I just see the box. I mean, look, this is what I used to do when I was a kid. I used to browse the horror section at Blockbuster and just like look at all the covers and just be like, oh man, one day I'll rent you. But not when I'm like 10 years old and my parents won't let me.
I ask because that is a ridiculous movie that has the trappings of horror but is so stupid that no one could ever be scared of it. Unless you're my friend Caroline, whose father made her watch it when she was 5. And the irrational fear of clowns sticks around to this day. And in fact, she didn't even know that movie was the reason she was scared of them until we were all drunk and we put it on and she was flipping out. And at some point she said, if a snake pops out of that laundry hamper with a clown's face on it, I'm going to scream. And everyone in the room was like, what are you talking about? Like, what are the odds of that happening? And it did. And so we found out that movie scared her so much that it scarred her from clowns for life. And she forgot that she'd ever seen it. That is
her mind had literally erased it.
It had snapped.
Like, no much.
She might need therapy.
She might, for reasons not even related to the clown film, but the clown film can't help. But that's what I'm looking for. That's what I wanted to hear about. So, Mike, old Snidell, you had said that you actually have trouble getting scared at movies now, and that video games usually do it for you more.
Yeah.
I'd love for you to like name check two video games before giving us your movie selection.
Did you?
Sure.
Can I put one in there real quick?
Game?
Go ahead.
Yeah, Dead Space, because that does a really good job of A, giving you limited ammo, and then B, putting you in super tense situations with things just crawling towards you, where you're just like, well, you know what? I guess I'm going to have to go hand-to-hand with this bad boy, and I really don't want to.
Bill, it's interesting, because I have a similar reason for thinking that... Silent Hill 2 might be the scariest thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of there. I think it all kind of started with Resident Evil, where it was like limited you to the amount of ammo, so you couldn't just you have, like, go into bullets. A room. Yeah, you couldn't go into a room where you're just like, yeah, I got this. You'd be like, I gotta take my shots very carefully. Oh my God, it's on me. Okay.
Yeah, my friends and I were playing Silent Hill 2 in a friend's basement with surround sound, taking turns on the controller, and a friend of mine was like, he could barely move the avatar on the screen because he was so terrified. He's like, I'm not moving. And we're like, you have to move. You're in the middle of the street. Why aren't you moving? And he said, because the second I move, some unholy godly terror with no face is going to jump out at me. And all I have is a fucking board with a nail in it. And the second he screamed that, an ungodly horror with no face jumped out from behind a car and grabbed his leg. And we all screamed and we lost the remote control for a while. It was great. So Michael Snydell, why don't you give us a video game and then tell us your movie pick?
Sure. Well, the reasons I mentioned the video games to you when you were asking me about this question earlier is that, you know, there's been movies that have scared me the past few years, but there's been nothing that's quite scared me last year like P.T. And, you know, I'll put in if you're asking for two, I'll say P.T. and Soma. But P.T. was the one that scared the fuck out of me. And interestingly enough, I'm going to have a good segue because P.T. actually goes into many of the subjects that I'm most scared of. And so for people who aren't familiar, P.T. was a demo for a Silent Hill game that was canceled by Hideo Kojima.
Okay, yeah. I believe this
is right. Should have done research on this.
I did a little. I heard about this when it happened, and I looked it up today. So you were right. It was Hideo Kojima and Guillermo del Toro.
Yes.
And it was
a
playable teaser for the game Silent Hills.
And it no longer exists.
No, it doesn't.
On PSN, which is super creepy. So I now have something.
Not only that, you can't reinstall it.
Exactly.
Okay. So did you like unplug your PS4, PS3?
It won't uninstall it for you, but if he were to take it off, he could never get it back.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And it is
that
one
game
of
is
those,
haunted.
No, it feels that way. And
you're
it's
coming over,
it's,
by the way. You live in what, Chicago? I'm there next week.
No, it's an amazing experience, although I still haven't played it for longer than 30 to 45 minutes at a time because it's essentially a loop of one hallway, and as you start playing with objects that are in the hallway, things start changing. And it's not good what happens. And I will leave it at that. And there is actually a way to beat it, and it's insane, and it took people over 24 hours of trying different things.
Oh, and this is just the teaser.
This is just the teaser.
Yeah. To a game that now will never happen.
Yeah.
That's sad.
And then I'll briefly mention Soma since I mentioned it. Soma's from the guys who did Amnesia.
Oh, that game scared the fuck out of me.
And Soma is in a underwater biosphere is the best way to put it. It's not quite like BioShock though, because of course you have nothing to defend yourself against some really creepy creatures that I don't really want to talk about the origins of, but it's a fantastic game that plays with the idea
that
of like
art. Loves that
they do
like not giving you anything. In fact, in Amnesia, you couldn't even look at the monsters.
Yep, that's the case here too.
That was sweet. I may have to look into this then.
Oh man,
they're both excellent games. So I would, well, PT, I guess you can't do anything with.
No,
but Soma is still available and probably cheaper at this point because it came out in the fall of last year.
So that's the film stage roundtable firmly in the games are art realm. So
yes.
Love us.
Yes.
Okay, so the movie I was going to talk about, and it's one that scared me when I was pretty young because it came out, I believe, when I'm going to age myself here. I think I was in sixth or seventh grade when it came out, and it was Gore Verbinski's remake of The Ring.
Yes.
And I saw it with my best friend at the time. And I tell this to so many people.
7 days.
I was in my basement with my friend, and there's a rotary phone downstairs. Oh, God. And there was a phone call literally the second the actual video in the movie finishes. So I was like, holy fucking shit, we're going to die. So
now that movie, I know in my group of friends was like, when did that come out? Was that?
I think it was, okay.
96? 98? Somewhere around there?
Really?
2002.
Okay. So what? I was 15-ish when that came out. And that was like the date movie. It was like, oh, bro.
Sure.
You want to hold this girl's hand? You take her to see the goddamn ring, man.
Freak her the fuck out.
Yeah, man. That's what seems like a great idea. Let's be real. As a teenager, that's what scary movies are for. It's like, oh, it's okay, baby. I'll protect you. The only problem is that in that movie, they make it pretty clear that no one can protect you. So everyone is terrified.
Yeah, it's interestingly enough, I actually watched Ringu a little bit earlier this year, and I liked it. But I still actually think the American remake is better. I don't know if that's...
There is a sequel coming out.
Yeah, I saw the trailer from that. It looks like something, but...
we'll leave it at that. Looks like something.
Yeah.
Something I'm not going to see.
But for years, that movie still scared the fuck out of me. And embarrassingly, even when Scary Movie 3 came out, you know, it plays with The Ring for a little bit, and I was still like freaked out a little bit when it first showed up. I'm like, oh god damn it, I really can't get away from this, can I?
No, that was the beginning of the J-horror invasion.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that like kept going with, what was it, Pulse, and then the grudge,
The Eye,
Dark Water.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that cell phone movie? Not the Pulse.
One Missed Call,
yeah. I mean, The Ring did it first. It did it best. I mean, Gore Verbinski's a pretty fantastic director.
For sure.
I just remember that movie looking just like wet and mossy and evil. All right. Well, Bill Graham, what is a horror movie that scared the ever-loving shit out of you? Or, like I said, not just horror movie. Maybe you were super afraid of An Inconvenient Truth.
This film came out 2 years before I was born. Okay. It came out in 1984, and it was a pretty, it was on repeat for a lot of my early childhood. I'm not sure if I saw it in school and then kept on seeing it on TV or what was going on.
Super
but
interested to figure out what this is. It was playing in your school.
Yeah. So this film is called The Never Ending Story.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this film really, really fucked me up for a long time. And I still don't think I'm sitting here looking at the list of characters and I still can't find the fucking name of this creature.
What was it?
It was The Wolf.
The Wolf, The Wolf. Oh, my God. No, I know what you mean. That movie was like, I feel like that movie was just on constantly in my house. And I don't know why.
I loved everything around it except The Wolf. And The Wolf, that sequence when Atreyu is trying to help out his horse and get him out of there.
Horse is like getting mired in the mud
and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And the whole time
I'm looking at this on Google Images and I'm about to have nightmares.
It's horrifying.
I literally still cannot find the name of the bad guy. Why?
You could just Google like what? Never Ending Story Wolf.
Well, oh, the Gamork.
Is it the Gamork?
Yeah.
There it is. Yeah. The Gamork. So that's why, because I'm looking at it and I'm trying to see who the voice is. And I guess Alan Oppenheimer, this bastard does double duty as Falcor and Gamork.
So he's like, the luck dragon and the horrifying wolf beast.
Yes. Like, what is that about?
Atreyu stabs it to death with a piece of glass or something?
I honestly can't watch this film.
I would run out of the room. I remember that. And I felt so bad for that fucking horse, and I was like just so sad, and then this stupid wolf shows up and I'm like, you know what, I'm done. And yeah. Of course I was like four, so I wasn't that pithy or vulgar about it, but yeah.
And I kept watching it. Like, I just remember always watching it and then getting to that part and just freaking myself out. It was like one of those bad dreams where you're thinking that a different ending is going to happen, like for the horse, and it just continuously does not happen, and so it just continues to freak yourself out. So this film is very interesting because it's got a tone that apparently the writer, I don't know if y'all have heard about this, but his name is Michael Ende, and he was a German writer, and he became aware of the adaptation of his book. And I guess he had gotten the script and, had kind of gotten some notes from during the production. And he basically sued them. And he sued them to try and keep them from making the film and to try and keep his name away from it. And from my understanding, neither of those happened.
Well, obviously we have this movie.
Yes.
I remember
in the sequel.
Like, I can't think of the plot of this movie. Like, I know there's a boy reading a book, and I know I've seen it at least once, but I just have this collection of like nightmare images. Mm-hmm. Like this this sad like 11-year-old girl who's like, oh, we're all gonna die, like, yeah, and then this kid like in an attic and it's thunder and lightning and he's like, no, and
it's just like,
the kid, the boy who's like reading the story. And it's like, you know, you have to name the princess. And he's like, oh, my God. And I'm like, just say it, Anna, or something, you piece of shit.
Yeah, this film, I don't know. I don't know if it holds up at all. I need to have make sure that the Alamo near me plays it one time soon so I can just relive my childhood like nightmares over again.
Finally figure out
you know, maybe if I can get over it or something. But I don't know, guys. This film, it really messed with me for a long, long time. I still have like a ridiculous fear of wolves. Probably just because of this film. I'll go ahead and say that. If I ever see a wolf talk, I'm done, guys. Done. So
don't see The Jungle Book again. So
guys,
for me,
I'm just saying this wolf looks a lot like the cat in Coraline, and I'm sorry if I just ruined Coraline for either of you, but having just watched Coraline, this wolf looks a lot like the cat in Coraline.
It does, actually, now that you say that. All right, so mine. All right. I apologize if I have a panic attack while I talk about this movie. This movie touches on like 14 different things that kind of like freak me out.
Oh, jeez.
So the movie was released in 2005. I don't think I saw it until 2006 because I definitely watched it in my college dorm. And that's how horrifying it is that even though I watched like Jaws when I was 10, like I don't have a problem with open water. I'm fine.
Oh, no, I do.
You know,
things like that. Not so much, but
I know what you're going to say.
I watched The Descent.
Okay. Yeah.
In a dark room with a friend of mine on a tiny TV, and I had a bottle of Jack Daniels that I was swinging from to like try to calm down.
This
movie just, I was like pacing in the dorm room. I was like cursing at my friend because he made me watch it, and I was just like, fuck you Tony, like what is wrong with you? Because it's about a bunch of women who are going cave diving. And that alone would be enough for me. Like, these women are crawling through caves that they shouldn't be able to fit through. And there's a point where one of them gets stuck and is, like, panicking. And it's, like, all source lighting, you know? So the caves are, like, super dark except for their headlamps. And it's just, and then it's dark and they can't get out. And I'm, like, freaking out. And then all of a sudden, this woman looks across a subterranean lake and sees this pale creature on the other side that stares at her and then scampers off. And I turned to my friend and I said, there are fucking monsters too. For some reason, I didn't know that. I have never been more horrified I have never watched the movie again. I own it because it's a good movie, but yep. I have never been able to make myself watch it for a second time because I am honestly both terrified of seeing it again and super embarrassed of people seeing me see it again because nothing has ever horrified me as much. And I don't think I have a fear of caves, but I'll be fucked before I go and try to figure it out. It's everything that's awful about the world in a single movie. And I just, they were like crawling through caves and I'm like, who does this? Why would they do this? Like, who finds pleasure from doing this? And then the monsters happen. And the monsters are horrifying, cave-dwelling, wall-climbing troglodytes. And I almost died. But I'm okay. Fuck you, Neil Marshall. You've directed some good episodes of Game of Thrones, but you also made The Descent, and I will never forgive you, because The Descent really screwed me up, man.
I feel like we should talk about his previous film. Isn't it called Wolf Soldiers or something like that, too? Oh, Bill, can you handle that one?
Wolf Soldiers?
Did you ever see Wolf Soldiers?
No, I haven't seen that. But yeah, I'm not
a dog soldiers. Whoops.
Super huge fan of werewolf films.
I remember wanting to see Dog Soldiers, but now I'm like, I'm just going to hang back from Neil Marshall for a sec because no one has ever screwed me up that bad. I will say, honorary mention goes to It Follows, the only film since The Descent, really, to give me a nightmare.
Did you see that in the theater?
Yes, I did.
Nice.
And it was horrifying, and I was on the edge of my seat. But then, you know, I left, and I was like, that's fine, whatever. Like, there could be things living in caves. I'm pretty sure there's not a specter following people around after they have sex. But I'll be damned if I didn't have a nightmare about it following me.
So here's the freaky thing about what you just described, because you may not have gotten the actual normal.
Oh, no, I watched the original English cut.
You mean the unedited version?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. I didn't see it in American theaters.
Okay.
So
that ending.
That ending, man, when she's there with the birthday cake and I'm just like, what the shit, bro? Oh my god.
So it's funny, you know, this film was so successful that it's literally made there's the cave. Doesn't the cave have
the cave has like a giant monster. Then there was Sanctum, which was just
The cave has Lena Headey. And then Piper Perabo, Daniel Day-Kim. Wow, that film's got a lot of people I recognize. And then, yeah, there was the one that was made. What is this called? It's called spelunking, right?
Yeah, spelunking, yeah. Cave diving, or
yeah. Yeah, so this is just kind of set off a whole slew of films like this.
The caving genre didn't take off as much as people wanted it.
There's also Catacombs, which has a very similar claustrophobia. Well, I mean, claustrophobia is pretty common, but Catacombs has a relatively similar texture.
There was a woman on Twitter who mentioned this, and we're actually about to get to our feedback, which will take 14 hours to get through. So I'm sure I'll read her tweet aloud, but she also mentioned this film, and then she said she has such a problem with like subterranean films that even a movie like As Above, So Below, which she said was not good, still freaked her out just because it's a bunch of people trapped underground. And I remember seeing the trailers for As Above, So Below and thinking that doesn't look great. I'm still not going to see it even to laugh at it because I don't want to have a panic attack. I might just have a problem. I don't think I have a problem with like enclosed spaces because I've been on like a crowded subway. I have no problem with elevators, but I don't know if it's made of rock and I have to squeeze through it. That's not a happy moment for me. So speaking of our feedback, we have two feedback rounds because we're crazy.
Jeez.
So let's see how many Rockin' Robins it takes to get through everything that you, the fine folks at home, said was on your films that scared the shit out of me list. Deep breath. All right. Jerry Maravilla said Jesus Christ Superstar. Marshall Schaefer said Requiem for a Dream. Okay, I'm not going to be able to read that. Sergiumd, I apologize, said Funny Games, 1998 version. Mike Mazanti, I'm really screwing up today, said Safe by Tom Haines. Lena said Seven, Faux Show. Johnny said Kind of Want to Say Eyes Wide Shut. Alice says Snowpiercer, had nightmares for 3 days. A star symbol, whose handle is at CinemaHo, said Mysterious Skin. A bunch of other symbols, that's at underscore flower prince, said Agreeing on Mysterious Skin. I was traumatized for days afterwards. We also have Jay, who says Trilogy of Terror. Jay Runham, who says Requiem for a Dream. Amazing film that I'll never watch again because it scared me shitless. Anna said The Descent. There you are, Anna. And we also have Sarah, who said Pink Flamingos. Colin Biggs said The Green Mile. Tommy Surya Pradhana said Grave of the Fireflies. Scotty Rock says The Exorcist, saw it way too young. Chris, with no H, says Evil Dead Remake, Candyman, or Exorcism of Emily Rose. I did ask him, and yes, as with all people who saw Candyman, his older brother did lock him in a bathroom and make him say Candyman.
Oh, what the hell?
Charlie Bridgden said Alien. Kyle Wade, I used to work with kids, so The Hunt. John Joseph said Bergman's Cries and Whispers. I don't know how to read. I assume that this is Japanese, actually. But this person said, Gone Girl. It was traumatic for me. Buffalo Tony says, Precious. Rahul Adusamili, apologies, said, Signs. Remington Morris said, The Strangers, which I can agree on. Tom said, Come and See. AJ Singh said, A Serbian film. My immediate thought was, What Monster Made This? Oh my god, we have some crazy names today, and I'm super sad that I am an American who can't pronounce foreign names for shit. Sanauli Dai, I am again sorry. In recent memory, Prometheus, Sicario, Bone Tomahawk, The Witch scared the shit out of me.
Bone Tomahawk.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Simone said Eraserhead by far. Philip Kennedy, Blue Valentine, while in a happy relationship. We're losing the song, so I am going to start it over again. Casey said, The Tribe, Requiem for a Dream, and Larry Clark's Kids. P.S. Does watching 10 minutes of Gummo before feeling so sick I had to turn it off count? Casey, yes, it does. From Facebook, my wife said, An American Crime with Ellen Page and Trust with Clive Owen both kept me up for weeks. It's truly horrifying how evil humans can be. Brendan Kennedy said, Requiem for a Dream. Bobby Green said, I was way too drawn in with Paranormal Activity, ended up paying dearly. Also, ooh, any documentary about Congress. Bernard Rowan, that's my father, said The Crawling Eye, no question at all. And yes, as a child, I remember him telling me this was the most terrifying movie he'd ever seen. Joanna Klebis, Jurassic Park. I was 10 and begged to see it because all the older kids are seeing it. And I spent the entire time with my hands over my face. Trisha Coburn said The Ring. Joanna Salerno said Gummo. We got another Gummo. Ryan Green, Black Christmas, maybe 10 years old when I saw a woman impaled through her boobs with a set of reindeer antlers.
Boy.
On a wall. LeVar Poison, The Shining, and El Orfanato stand out in my mind. Rob Bickmore, Can I Count Salem's Lot? It was a TV show when I saw it as a kid. I still don't like looking out of windows at night. If not allowed, then The Exorcist takes it. I think I was about 12. John Nix says Exorcist 3 and Mulholland Drive. Corey Poznanski said, haven't had chills quite like I did when I watched The Witch in a very long time. Caitlin Grace, The Ring. It scared me shitless at 15. And woo, Christopher Parks said it.
I got two more.
You got two more?
Yep. Right. Todd Gilchrist said he didn't know what at the time because he was a child, but the bedroom scene in Salem's Lot terrified him.
Okay.
And he also said the sequence in Thriller where Michael Jackson's face is growing out. He said that's always been a little wicked for him. Yeah. Ben LaFleur said Tim Curry is Pennywise.
Yep, that would be it. It the movie, not it the end. But that is actually at the end, too. So two Rockin' Robins to get through all the scary movies. We used to be able to do this in one Rockin' Robin. Apparently we're getting more popular. Whew.
That terrible does, thing. Terrible thing.
Terrible thing to be popular. I don't know why people want it so much. But now here we are. We're about to get into our second topic. Well, I've lost my ability to speak. I hope that someone else will be able to host when I die. All right. This topic is called High Scores. That, of course, is the famous song from every trailer ever made that's trying to get across the idea of strife. Also originally from Requiem for a Dream. Whew. All right. We had a Twitter suggestion. Luis, I believe is how you say that name, asked if we would consider talking about our favorite movie scores and composers. Now, that is a huge topic, a massive topic. So to narrow it down, we decided we would talk about our favorite scores from the last 16 years, going along with all of the different lists that we've been publishing on the film stage. Except this time, we're the only ones, bitches.
No.
It's just us. There's not a list coming on the film stage currently. All right. Well, we considered it, and here we are. The three of us have chosen some of our favorite scores of this new century, and in addition to talking about them and why they found our favor, I have created personalized melodies for each of us.
Woo!
Medleys. I keep doing that when I say it out loud. That will play before our opinions. Whew. Guys, this is gonna be fun. Yep. It's gonna be a good time. Are you all excited?
Sure.
I am.
Mike with the sure.
Are we gonna touch on the Inception bomb? And,
yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if we had that kind of queued up already.
No, I don't. I don't have the brrrr. But there are.
If you don't know what the hell we're talking about, surely by now you do. Like,
yeah. It's that sound that happens in the dark parts of trailers now, in between the quick cuts between action scenes. Yeah, Requiem for a Dream, Inception. Those are the songs that have come to define our trailer sonic universe.
I would say Howard Shore as well. I know we were talking about this a little bit earlier amongst each other, but I'd say those three.
I wanted to lay out some stuff. We had questions about what counted between a score and a soundtrack.
Yeah, we did.
One day we will talk about soundtracks because I think that'll be super fun. When I can just spend half an hour telling everyone that Top Gun has the greatest soundtrack of all time.
You're so predictable, Brad.
Look, man, if we were doing the opposite of movies that scared the shit out of us and were the movies that like empowered us the most throughout our life, mine would have to be Top Gun. Because I watched that movie every day for like, I don't know, 3 to 7.
Have you ever read Amy Nicholson's analysis of Top Gun?
No, I read her thing about how Tom Cruise isn't really crazy, though.
Oh, I haven't read that one, but I would recommend that one.
I will have to do that. So, this is how it's going to work. I took 4 to 5 songs from each of the lists that you guys supplied me with, and I made medleys out of them. A medley is a song composed of bits of other songs, kind of like a musical review. A melody is what you could call the front part of a composition. It is not the beat in the back. It is the part that gets stuck in your head and you whistle to yourself. So medley. We have medleys set up.
I like the music theory in this episode.
Well, you gotta know. You gotta know what a score is. You gotta know what a soundtrack is. You gotta speak specifically. So, we're going to play our medleys as we introduce each person's opinion point, and then they're going to talk about their top one or two scores. Does either of you have any desire to go first?
I will.
All right, Bill's going to go first. I should have all this queued up, so with any luck, here is Bill's medley. Now, glorious. It's going to be funny because there is going to be some crossover between movies that scared the shit out of us and movie scores that we really love. I can tell you right now that both It Follows and Requiem for a Dream come up a lot in both. So, Phil Graham, why don't you walk us through the two favorite scores of yours from the last 16 years?
So, the first one was pretty damn easy, I'll be honest. This is Tron Legacy by Daft Punk and Joseph Trapanese. And I want to emphasize Joseph Trapanese because I don't think he gets enough love for his contribution to this score. He is the man that basically came up with the compositions and things like that. So, Daft Punk had obviously never worked with a orchestra, things like this before. And so when they were kind of given the reins, they realized, hey, we need someone to kind of help us out here. We don't want to just learn this on the fly and then, you know, make a big gaffe of this. Tron had meant a lot to both of the members of Daft Punk. And so that's where Joseph Trapanese kind of came in. I do hope I am pronouncing his name right, but he really what this film really does well is it blends both some of my favorite things. I love electronic music and I love orchestral scores, and it blends both of these in a way that's really, really it's just hard to emphasize enough how much this just kind of hits me right at home for everything that I want from a score itself. I've continued to listen to this score by itself ever since the film came out, and it's constantly on my, you know, Spotify rotation. It's constantly coming up. It's funny because now people hear little bits of it and they're like, is that from Stranger Things? And I'm like, guys, your electronic music just no, that
isn't Stranger Things.
I know. it's like, come on, guys, 80s synth pop. And you're going to run into Tron
people
Legacy.
Hear like Sweet Dreams and they're like, oh, is that Stranger Things?
Yeah, it's like, ah, come on, guys. All right. Anyways, but so the film, to the point where I've continuously listened to it all the way through, and I've actually sought out because the track on or the entire score that you can get online is like 52 minutes. Obviously, the film is closer to 2 hours, and there's a lot of music that was just, you know, cut out to put on the OST, the original sound is that what it's called? OST? What am I?
It is called the score. Score album.
Yeah, the score. Anyways, I've actually sought out. You can kind of find it online. You can get the entire secluded score that people have basically taken the Blu-ray and then taken out all the audio files, and then
so they just like, cracked the Blu-ray to get the score.
Yeah,
the full
they isolated the tracks, and then they even used like software to like make sure like the sound effects were taken away from the score, and so now you can have like an hour and 52 minute score.
Well, that movie was by Joseph Kaczynski.
Yes.
And
Oblivion, dude.
Oblivion got name checked, I think, by someone in our feedback. I mean, this guy is. That was M83, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was M83.
Say what you will about his
soundtrack.
And I think that he actually is a fine visual stylist in search of a much better story.
Sure.
But, I mean, you can't deny that his scores are on point when he comes time to get someone to help him out with that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So what is your second choice?
So my second choice is going to be How to Train Your Dragon.
Woo!
And this is music by John Powell. This film, I'll admit that I never caught it in theaters.
Me neither, Bill. It's cool.
there was something going on around that time, I guess in 2010. I guess I had probably just graduated. No, I graduated in 2009. I'm trying to figure out what was going on.
Why you missed it?
Yeah, I don't.
Just, I mean, it's a kids movie. It happens.
Nah.
But the score obviously stuck with you when you finally saw it.
The score definitely stuck with you. Yeah, stuck with me. And it's one of those things where it was really difficult to kind of come up with a second. Like I said, the first one, I mean, I've listened to the Legacy soundtrack probably 200, 300 times. The second score was really a struggle choosing, because I didn't want to choose something that a lot of people would have chosen, whether it was Mad Max, things like It Follows and The Grand Budapest Hotel. I think all of those film scores are excellent in their own right. But
see, Bill, you got to be like me and just choose from the heart, man.
You know, this one, I think what it does is it elevates an animated feature to something a little bit more. I don't think the score gets enough credit for some of the sequences and how it's integrated.
This is true, because people talk about the score for like Up and stuff, mm-hmm. but you're the first person I've ever heard really like name check the score for How to Train Your Dragon.
It's a fantastic score. It really is. The more and more I listened to it, you know, while we were coming up with these lists, the more I was just like, wow, this is something else. And it's funny because what it does so well is that it's integrated into the film, and it's so present that when you hear the certain bits of this score, you can recognize the moments that, you know, are happening in the film and things like that. And I think I think just like Signs, just like a lot of these other films, I think that's the perfect integration when you can literally isolate the score and visually you can just tell what's going on in the film. I think that's a powerful integration of both sound and visuals there.
That's something that not a lot of things can really pull off. All right.
Yeah, no, I just want to say about that album, Bill, Forbidden Friendship. That's one of like my most listened to songs off that album. And you know exactly, and that song is so perfect because it's the moment where Toothless and, the main character's name? Hiccup first start to have their friendship. And just when you start listening to that song, it's like you hear the whole evolution in that friendship within the course of a 3 or 4 minute song. And it's such a wonderful sensation, as you were talking about.
I'll go ahead and follow up with my honorables. It Follows, Man of Steel, Sicario, Mad Max, Pan's Labyrinth, Signs, and The Grand Budapest.
All right.
Nice.
Here we are. It's time for Mike's medley. Let's cue it up. All right, so that was Mike's medley. Mike Snydell. You know, it sounds really weird to say Mike and then your last name. What are your score choices?
Well, I'll start with the one that's pretty obvious. And it was actually in that medley. I believe the song that's in there is called Peer Pressure. And it's John Bryan's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Minds. And so, I mean, this is a film that's just kind of unimpeachable personally for me. So I don't even know where to start with my love of it. But the score is something that took a long time to actually grow on me. And I think it's especially because, you know, there's a few real earworms on that soundtrack. To name check a few, there's like one I really go back to is The Peer Pressure. And then another big one is that last song, which is like this 30-second acoustic guitar, just kind of a lullaby called Elephant Parade. But the rest of the album is a lot more it's a lot more distant. And I mean, I suppose that's reflecting the film. But I think it's a score that really works on its own as bringing across the strangeness and the joy of the movie itself. Mm-hmm. And I think John Bryan is really good at this. I actually waffled between picking this and his Paranorman score. Because I love the song, and I like Paranorman quite a bit, but I think John
Bryan's... Paranorman one is actually the one that I put in there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was Resolution. Oh, shoot. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I was going to let you slide, but since you brought it up, nope, the Paranorman one was the one that was in there.
But, and anyway, John Bryan is just, he's been so interesting. Especially when you think of the last 16 years, the ways that he's worked with, you know, people as diverse as Kanye West and Fiona Apple and, you know, some of the most diverse, like iconoclastic musicians of the last decade plus. And just looking at his journey as a composer, I think Eternal Sunshine is kind of the center that everything goes out of. And interestingly enough, to speak of Kanye West, actually, he sought out John Bryan when he was first making his second album, Late Registration, just because he was so moved by the music in Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind.
Oh, wow. I'm
ranting now, guys. But the point is... yeah, this is just one of those albums that I've continually gone back to, and it doesn't let you in immediately, but it really kind of takes you on the same journey as the movie, I guess.
Let me wait one second.
I gotta go check on the baby. Disaster, we lost a pacifier, but I'm back. All right.
I did want to ask a question.
Sure, go ahead.
And just slide that into the podcast real quick. One thing that I noticed that Michael was talking about kind of heavily was how much he loved the film. And look, I don't have a whole lot of love for Tron Legacy. You know, my Jeff Bridges kind of, you know, love can only take me so far with that film. Yeah. Visually, it's outstanding, but I do wonder when y'all were coming up with these picks, whether it was necessarily a film that y'all had to love, or
I find that for me at least, most of the films that I chose the scores for, the scores had an emotional attachment to me that was related to the film.
Mm-hmm.
Now that being said, no love for Tron Legacy, but that's a great score. So I definitely don't need the movie to be good for me to appreciate the score.
I just think there's obviously two ways to listen to a score, right?
Sure.
There's listening to it by itself, and then there's also watching the movie a shit ton of times, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm always curious how people get, you know, are how they kind of relate to a score. Is it necessarily they watched a film once and then they just bought the score and then
that's
continued
how most of mine went.
Yeah. Whether you're reliving those memories or whether you have a separate attachment.
Right. Like I bought, when I was a kid, I bought the score for The Lost World on cassette tape. That was purely because I liked that movie and wanted to have a piece of it. I don't think that that holds up. But for most of mine, which I guess I'll get to play pretty much now, once Mike runs through his runners-ups.
Oh, wait, did you want me to go through my second one, or did you want to just skip ahead?
What was your second one, yeah.
Oh, sorry, guys. I just wanted to quickly respond to Bill's question. Hannah was in my medley, Hannah.
Yes.
Hannah was in my medley, and I don't particularly like that film. And another
which
one.
Crazy.
oh boy, another controversial opinion. Not Running Down yet. Okay, and my second choice is Max Richter's score for Waltz with Bashir.
I would love to be able to give Max Richter a prize for his score for The Leftovers.
I mean, you can give that prize, Brian. There's no one to
well,
stop you.
The Brian Rowan Prize for scores for television series that not enough people watch goes to Max Richter. Hooray, Max. You can pick up your item in DC. Tweet at me when you're here.
So Richter, I have a previous relationship with his music. His album The Blue Notebooks, which I don't know what year that's from, that's been my writing soundtrack for going on a decade plus now. So it's one of those things that the movie and that album, which the Waltz with Bashir soundtrack is, I believe, made up from about at least a handful of tracks from Blue Notebooks.
Much as The Leftovers is from Memory House.
Sure.
Yeah,
interesting. So he kind of recycles stuff.
Yeah, but he does different arrangements.
Right.
Adds.
Arrangements and variations are his game, and they really are like brand new pieces.
Yeah.
He'll choose different instruments. But anyway, this is your choice.
No, so, it's...
I just love Max Richter. I'm glad.
You know, Max Richter he's fantastic. But what I find very interesting about him is that he's in that crop of, adult contemporary composers. But I rarely listen to his music and think, okay, this is getting too, his music never becomes a sedative. It always has enough wrinkles and, whether he's playing with drones and things like that. Actually, the song I picked in the medley, Shadow Journals, is really interesting because the bass like sounds like there's an earthquake that just happens to be happening in the song. And I picked that particular soundtrack, the Waltz with Bashir one, just because I don't think I've ever seen a documentary that feels so defined by its soundtrack without feeling overwhelmed by it. And Richter's music is just such a, I'm gonna have to pronounce this. Is it elegiac? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. it has such an elegiac tone, and it brings across the ghosts that are already so present in that movie. And the music is just such a perfect accompaniment to that. And so, yeah, listen to Max Richter because he's great.
Yes, please do. All right. We're running low on time, so I will run through my medley and then I will give my choices pretty quickly because I feel like they're self-evident. And if you don't agree with me, you're a fool. So for once, my pompousness helps us out. Here we go. My medley. Thank you. All right. That was my medley. The most beautiful of all the medleys. And that's because it has songs from two different Joe Wright films. Because, like I was saying earlier, the guy knows how to pick them.
He does.
And those are both composed by the same man, Dario Marianelli.
Who did Kubo as well.
Yes, he did. I saw that when I looked him up for this. I was like, oh, damn. He also did Box Trolls, which is pretty great.
Yeah. I loved that score.
Yeah, that's I mean, score. This guy is pretty much knocking it out of the park. He also did the score. This is just funny to note. For Shrooms, have any of you seen Shrooms?
Uh-uh. I haven't seen it, but I'm aware of it.
Irish horror film about like people who go out into the wilderness to take mushrooms and then start killing each other, and they don't know for sure if they're doing it or if it's a hallucination. It's not as good as its poster, which is a moon with some mushrooms that makes it look like a skull. But it's fine. His work, I couldn't choose. It was hard to choose, I should say, since I obviously made a choice between Anna Karenina and Atonement. Because as a man who owns upwards of seven antique typewriters, there's something fantastic about Atonement using a typewriter in that way to kind of give a backbeat to this fantastic orchestral score. Mm-hmm. With the piano and everything. Oh my god. And then the violins kick in, and it's like you can hear the thoughts of this girl who's racing through this field and really get a sense of like the mystery and uncertainty with that piano. I have a problem. I can talk way too much about music, and it's something I don't get to do a lot. So I'm gonna say that Atonement is fantastic. Anna Karenina is one of my favorite books. I've read it three times, which is insane if you've ever seen it. I read it when I was 15, then when I was 20, and then when I was 25. And so I'm pretty much due for another read through. Because it is one of those.
Do you have the same copy?
Yeah.
Wow.
It is really, really disgusting. I dropped it in a puddle once, and I couldn't find the same printing, so I put it in an oven and dried it out.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I'm super weirdly obsessive compulsive about my books. And I don't say that lightly. My wife, who actually is diagnosed obsessive compulsive, says that with books and my fingernails, oddly enough, I actually outstrip her obsessiveness.
So
I'm not just being glib. That's some real shit that I just laid down on you.
So what you're saying is you will never own this on a Kindle.
No, I do own a Kindle, but I got it mainly to get a whole bunch of books for free because of all the stuff in the public domain.
Yeah.
But also nice. Because I have certain authors who I only buy in hardback, and then that's really difficult for me to lug around and keep the dust cover nice on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I won't read a book that's hardback without the dust cover on. This is crazy. What are we talking about? Let's go back. I chose Anna Karenina because I will be walking down the street and find myself whistling Anna Karenina's score. And I find that it is a perfect use of kind of leitmotifs for each character that twine together and change depending upon the mood. And you can tell, you know, we were talking about this earlier, you can tell depending on which track it is exactly which moment in the movie it is and what the feelings are and what everyone's going through. And it's just amazing. And the fact that that movie has such a balletic tone and energy to it, it really just melds together so that it's at once inextricable from the film, but I also feel like if I put that on at a party, people would be into it without ever even having seen the film. It's a strange amalgamation of, you know, Bill, you were talking about, like, can we like something that's not in a movie we like? And I feel like it's hard to take something away from a movie, especially if it fits it so well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I don't know how to even describe the Anna Karenina soundtrack. And then the second one I chose was The Fountain by Clint Mansell.
Who I believe him and Cliff Martinez, because I wanted to include both of them in my own honorables and even close to my second pick. But I don't think either of them have ever been nominated for an Oscar, which just blows my fucking mind.
Wait, that's crazy.
If that is true, I'm going to kill someone. No, apparently, I'm looking at Clint Mansell's right now, and it only says Golden Globe.
Yep.
For best score for The Fountain.
Which everybody knows the Golden Globes are bullshit.
So crazy, though, because I feel like this is the only time when the Golden Globes have outstripped the Oscars, because Clint Mansell should be nominated for just about everything he does.
Yep. And same with Martinez.
Martinez does not either.
Yeah.
Dario Marianelli, I believe, was at least nominated. Oh, he did win one Oscar, and that was in 2008 for Atonement. He was nominated for Anna Karenina, though, so we're all good there. But yeah, Clint Mansell, I mean, he burst onto my radar with Requiem for a Dream, of course.
Yep.
And since then, I mean, just everything this guy has touched has been pretty much golden in my eyes. And The Fountain, again, I know, I can see that movie in my head listening to the entire album, but it's also just so powerful on its own. And I think maybe that's what it is. Maybe these are pieces that perfectly evoke a set of emotions as they evolve and change, and they just happen to be linked up with films that have those same things. So that even divorced from the movie, it would still take you on that journey, but having it with that movie kind of doubles up the power.
You know, I do want to mention one thing that just kind of makes me really sad, and it's something that I've been kind of lacking on myself, is I don't listen to enough scores, I don't think. And it really blows my mind when you start listening to a lot of scores like we kind of did.
Yeah.
And you realize that these people have made 2 hours of music that a lot of people will watch a movie and be like, oh, that was great, and never listen to that ever again.
It's such a weird thing, because like you can make music, right? I know it's a dumb thing to say, but like you can make music as your thing, and these are people who are doing that and then slapping it on something else in order to enhance that thing. And it's just strange that like we kind of like give them an Oscar because why not? But I mean, we don't give them enough outside of like your John Williamses. My other honorary mentions were Nathan Johnson for Brick, which was the final piece of the medley.
Yeah.
And then Dan Romer and Ben Zeitlin for Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah.
Wait, should I go through my honorable mentions too? All right, Divergent Suicides, which is Air, In the Mood for Love, which is Shigeru Umebayashi. I'm so sorry that I butchered that. Inherent Vice, which is Johnny Greenwood. And I believe someone already mentioned Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is Alexandra Desplat.
Desplat is great.
And Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor for Social Network, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Gone Girl.
Yeah, and I'll just say, like, you know, I'd love to have been able to throw it on a Terrence Malick, but so much of his is just pieces of classical music.
Same.
That it seems hard to do that. And then also, of course, the Christopher Nolan films almost universally have great ones. I especially like Interstellar with that crazy organ. And if I had been able to fit it into my medley as a sixth, I might have, but it just sounded very atonal to end on that. All right, so that's us. We have come to the end. It is time to do our last round of listener feedback.
Jesus.
This, I know that we're already like over an hour and we try to keep this to an hour. This will only take another half an hour, so everybody strap in and get ready to listen to Rockin' Robin for at least two times.
Time to mute.
All right, Pitt. I Am Pittman said Inception, Interstellar, Sicario, Birdman, Drive, It Follows, Tony Hines, There Will Be Blood, The Master, Fury Road, Brick, hell yeah, bro, Russ Eckel, Drive, The Dark Knight, Tron Legacy, The Fountain, Midnight Special, and Oblivion, parentheses, really, it's good, close parentheses, Jordan Rout, Benevolent Lord and Master, said Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, Carol, The Fountain, 25th Hour, Social Network, Sunshine, also a great one, can't believe I didn't think of that, Only Lovers Left Alive, Everything by Johnny Greenwood. Paul Sorrells, I don't know about favorite, but the Star Wars prequel scores always get left out of these lists. I will say that Phantom Menace, that has Duel of the Fates, was 1999, but we can still add those other two in, I guess. Jeremy Beck, Atonement, Beasts of the Southern Wild, How to Train Your Dragon, I Am Legend, Interstellar, Never Let Me Go, Oblivion, Star Trek, Z for Zachariah, Mason Daniel, Punch Drunk Love, Revenge of the Sith, Man of Steel, Tron, Legacy, The Master, Fury Road, Fellowship of the Ring, Rapscallion, Interstellar, Aziz, Drive, Upstream Color, great, good choice, Aziz, The Social Network, and anything Max Richter does. Hell yeah, Aziz.
Woo!
Rahul Adesumili, Social Network, The Counselor, Gone Girl, Interstellar, Tron Legacy, Zero Dark Thirty, Bourne, DJ Mecca. You gotta talk about Mansell's Requiem just because of its influences alone. Same with Inception and that brrrr sound. Rob Bickmore, no question, There Will Be Love, or maybe Tree of Life. Honestly, I don't know how to pronounce that foreign language, but at Godard Ozu, In the Mood for Love, Requiem for a Dream, Twice Born. Luis, who actually is the one who told us to do this. Pirates of the Caribbean, Lord of the Rings will always be epic. I also loved Hans Zimmer's work in The Holiday. Kenneth Kraheli, who I know I always say sorry for, I'm not going to this time because he constantly tells me I'm right. I'd say Tree of Life if I was unaware the best part of it were not OST. He says Taverner. Kenneth again, my actual picks. Spirited Away, Inception, Waltz with Bashir, Finding Nemo, Corey Fava, Interstellar, Film Studies at UWG, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross for David Finchner's The Social Network, Murtada, I Cook to the Theory of Everything. All right. Daniel Castaneda M. Carol, Under the Skin, The Social Network. Up, Mad Max Fury Road, The Grand Budapest
Under
Hotel.
Under the Skin.
We gotta start rocking on over again. Here we go. Round two. Free Kier, Only God Forgives, Sicario, Star Symbol, At Cinema Ho, Drive, Palo Alto, Gone Girl, Scott Adkins Fan, Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, Willem, Interstellar, Addy Nugroho, Perfume, Story of a Murderer, which is great. It's actually a very good one. He says by its Reinhold Heel, Johnny Klimek, and Tom Thickfer. Philip Kennedy says Moon, The Social Network, There Will Be Blood, Under the Skin, Getting More Love. Ridhoita Warman, Social Network, Drive, Sicario, Birdman. Myth Addict, which is an awesome name. The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. It is timeless. We also didn't give enough love to Nick Cave and Warren Ellis.
Yeah.
Really Tyler had water. Pacific Rim is given to us by I Seca. Come on, everyone. Also,
Ramin Djawadi, right? Yeah.
And Interstellar and Only God Forgives. Eric R. said Cloud Atlas, probably. Not really committing hard to this. Isabel said Drive. Alina, The Dark Knight. Hans Zimmer is God. 12 Bullets said The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or Black Swan. Black Swan takes a lot from Tchaikovsky, so I didn't say that, but that is also a good one. Celeste says The Adventures of Shark Girl and Lava Boy in 3D. What?
Okay.
That can't be right. Anyway, Sanyali Dahl, I am so sorry, says Jesse James, Lord of the Rings, Under the Skin, Carol, Only Lovers Left Alive, Interstellar, Fury Road. Kyle Wade said Fury Road, Under the Skin, Birdman, The Neon Demon and Drive. Head Over Heels says The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Enemy. Tyler Harford said Mad Max, Fury Road. Justin Gott said Social Network, no question. Ben Stark said, sure, Lord of the Rings. Giacchino, Incredibles, Powell, How to Train Your Dragon, Zimmer, Inception, Williams, Warhorse, Howard, Kong, Desplat, Budapest, Mansell, Fountain, Greenwood, There Will Be Blood, Burwell, True Grit, Dan Watson,
yeah.
Old Boy, Muhammad Asif, The Workmeister Harmonies, Lord of the Rings Trilogy, Under the Skin, A Serious Man, Fury Road, Only Lovers Left Alive, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Casey says The Guest, Drive, Inception, Interstellar, Inherent Vice, Gone Girl, Hunt for the Wilder People. Whew. And we didn't put this on Facebook, so we got lucky there.
Woo.
Because I don't think I could handle any more of those. Guys, you're awesome. You rock. We love, beyond words, getting these things from you.
Yep. Thank you
so
much.
Keep your eyes on the Twitter and the Facebook, because we're constantly on the lookout. And I would say we're going to try to give you more lead time, but you guys seem to do well in a pinch, so maybe we won't. Because sooner or later, I'm going to get tired of hearing Rockin' Robin.
You need to find something new.
It was super cute the first time we did it when I was able to fit everything into one playthrough, but now it's getting a little crazy. But that is it for today. Whew. Guys, we did it. I would like to remind everyone that the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema, selecting a new day every new day, selecting every day a brand new cinematic gem. I'm not even reading something. My brain's just not working. For you to enjoy, you can download it to your phone. Mubi brings you movies that you won't find on your Netflix Dead Zones or your Hulu Brush Fires. I don't know. Mubi is great. We love Mubi. Mubi loves us. And we together are giving you a gift that is 1 free month of Mubi to try for your very own. And that is if you go to mubi.com/filmstage. Whew. All right, guys, it's been a pleasure. Let us know what you thought of our crazy thoughts and opinion by finding us on iTunes, reaching out on Twitter at Filmstage Show. Obviously, some people don't need to be told that. Or Facebook by searching The Filmstage Show. And, of course, by going to thefilmstage.com and commenting on the episode pages that are posted when these go online. If you have any ideas for topics you want to hear about, compose a beautiful ballad that will get the idea across to us and then play it for us in person. Or, of course, you can just use those previously mentioned methods. That'll be fine. Speaking of contact us, let's tell the fine people at home where they can find us online. Michael Snydell.
You can find me talking about how much I like Max Richter at Twitter on at Snydell. On Twitter at Snydell. And you can also read things from me at the Film Stage Paste and other places, including a review this week for The Very Bad Morgan, which actually has a Max Richter score.
Oh, no. It's also got Anya Taylor-Joy from The Witch.
It's bad, though, but read my review.
Okay. Great. Bill Graham. Where can we find more of your work between now and whenever we do this again?
You can find me living on the grid at Twitter or on Twitter.
We're all dying right now.
Okay. And you can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and also freshfiction.tv.
And you can find me trying to compose beautiful, heartrending music on one of my 7 typewriters on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me on Letterboxd under that name. And you can find me writing for The Film Stage at thefilmstage.com. We don't know what our next topics will be, but rest assured that we will put them out to you when we know them. This weekend, we're going to be talking about Kate Plays Christine on the review show. So look forward to that. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. And we look forward to speaking with you next time.